What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Wednesday afternoon. Delighted to have you along. This program, if you're new to Catholic radio, well, this program is just for you if you are not a Catholic, per se. If you are some other religion, perhaps no religion at all, and you've got questions about the Catholic faith, that's why we are here. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also send us an email. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. All right, our producer, Pedro Quiles, ready to go here. Matt Kabinski handling the phones. Vanessa Sanchez, just back from the SEEK conference. She'll be handling social media, including YouTube. If you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook and you'd like to participate there, all you have to do is send us your question via the chat screen. By the way, if you're on YouTube, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. You get some wonderful content that way. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Oh, limping along, but, you know, making it.
You're actually on the crutches today.
Oh, yeah. I brought the crutches in today.
Now, is this some sort of cheap sympathy or what?
No, I don't like attracting the sympathy, but you know, it's I can kind of walk on my foot, but it's a long walk from my car to the studio, and
yeah.
I've done it for 2 days, and I kind of regretted it afterwards, so I thought I'd take a little load off today.
I think that's a good idea. We're going to lead off today with a question from our EWTN listener comment line.
Hello, my name's Daniel. I'm in Omaha, Nebraska, and my question is it okay or a mortal sin or a sin at all for a Catholic to say go to a Protestant church if their spouse is Protestant or a friend or whatever the case is and attend a worship service? I understand you're not supposed to receive the Eucharist or participate, really, but is that a sin, a mortal sin, and is that allowable? Thank you. Have a nice day.
Yeah, Daniel, thanks. I appreciate the question. It is permissible for Catholics to attend Protestant worship services. It is not permissible for Catholics to partake in their putative sacraments.
Mm.
So you can go sit and sing and listen and, you know, go to the Bible study and your piece, but we'll steer short. We'll fall short of, say, submitting to rebaptism or taking their Holy Communion.
Okay. Very good. And we have another question here. This is from Samuel, who says, in John 19:25, it says that Mary, the mother of Jesus, has a sister called Mary. Was that common to name siblings the same name?
Could be sister-in-law.
Sister-in-law.
Could be cousin.
Okay.
It's probably not biological sibling.
Gotcha. Eduardo wants to know, God commanded his people not to make idols, but my friend says Catholics do this. How do I refute this?
No, we don't. That's very simple. We don't make idols. So an idol is a sculpture that you make for purposes to which you offer worship, and Catholics do not offer worship to sculptures. We don't do that, right? We only offer worship to God, and I'll prove it to you, right? Because the principal act of worship is the offering of sacrifice. And Catholics absolutely offer sacrifice, but we offer sacrifice to God the Father in the context of the holy sacrifice of the Mass. You will not find Catholics, pouring out a libation on an altar to Zeus. You will not find us pouring out libations on an altar to Hera or Athena or whoever it might be. Or for that matter, to the Blessed Virgin Mary or to Saint Joseph or anybody else, right?
Yeah.
We do actually offer an oblation to God the Father, and it is the sacrifice of Christ's body and blood that we receive in Holy Communion that is present for us there on the Mass. And so there's a very strong conceptual distinction between the worship that we offer Almighty God and then what we do with images, which are effectively, as Mother Angelica used to say, holy reminders.
Yes.
They are there to lift one's heart and one's mind to things above, but definitely not to be the recipient of acts of worship.
Eduardo, thanks so much for your email. Let's go to another call we received overnight on the EWTN listener comment line.
Yes, hello, Dr. Anders. I wondered if you could please explain the reference to the 144,000 referenced in the book of Revelation. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So it probably is not lost on you that there were 12 tribes of Israel and 12 apostles. So that's a biblical number that's associated with the complete number of the people of God, right? And so 144,000 is a multiple of 12, obviously.
Yeah.
And it would seem to be a kind of symbolic way of expressing the fullness of the people of God. It should not be taken as a literal account of the total number of people who will be saved.
Okay. Appreciate that. Thanks so much for your call on the listener comment line. And you may want to write this number down, not to call right now, but to call, you know, whenever you want, like over the weekend. And that number is 205-795-5773. Here's one more email from Mark. What is the historicity of the Gospels? Some historians claim they are not historically accurate.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the Gospels are absolutely theological works that each has a theological agenda to present Christ to the world in a certain way, in a certain perspective, mm-hmm. and to elicit a certain kind of response. There's no doubt, it seems to me, and I think to the scholars, I'm not a biblical scholar, but I mean, I've read a lot of biblical scholarship and I've read the Gospels, that the apostles sometimes play a little fast and loose with the chronology of their narratives.
Okay.
And they tell the same stories sometimes, but they don't tell them in the same order. They don't tell them in the same way. And sometimes they make alterations from one gospel to another that can be quite stark. And so, I mean, I think the most rational explanation is that the gospel writers were working with a body of traditional material that predates the gospel writers. There's an oral tradition about mm-hmm. Jesus, mm-hmm. and that they engage in a certain amount of creative recombination in the for rhetorical purposes, because they're using the genre of literature to make theological points, and their theological points are compatible but not identical. You know, should that be a problem for Catholics? I don't think so. I don't think it's a problem at all, right? Because we relate to the Christ of the canonical Gospels.
Yes.
We don't have any other Christ other than the Christ of the canonical Gospels. And if you're Catholic, you believe the Gospels are inspired, so they give us what we need to know about Christ to be saved.
Mark, thanks so much for your email. We'll get to the phones in just a moment, including Leo in Ohio. Call now, 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. We are live, and we're waiting for your call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We'll get to the phones in a second. Something you may want to check out. It is absolutely free, and we're glad to be bringing it to you. It is the online learning series from EWTN. One of those is called In His Sandals, where we invite you to be still and sit with the Lord through In His Sandals, our own online video reflections with EWTN chaplain Father Joseph Mary Wolf. These are wonderful, wonderful programs. You can delve into the riches of the faith and grow closer to the Lord with these free video and study guides. Enroll today at learningseries.ewtn.com. Did I mention it's free? It is. learningseries.ewtn.com. Do check it out. You will be blessed. All right, if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Beginning today with Leo, a first-time caller in Ohio, listening on the Great Holy Family Radio. Hey, Leo, what's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I want to know exactly what is meant by when the priest is in the persona Christi.
Thank you.
Is that true for all the sacraments?
I appreciate the question. Yeah. So it means that the priest operates with Christ's delegated authority.
Okay.
In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, St. Paul says of the apostles, we have become Christ's co-laborers as if God were making his appeal through us. And that's a pretty good description of what the priest does on behalf of Jesus. He stands in the liturgy in the place of Christ, who is the great high priest, as his representative and empowered by his divine commission and with his authority. as the priest is persona Christi in virtue of his ordination. So it's something that adheres to his person, mm-hmm. just the way the sacrament of baptism adheres to your person, and you are imprinted with the baptismal character such that you're a member of Christ's body forever and anon, whether you want to be or not. You stay a member of Christ's body. In the same way, the priest is configured to Christ in this representative way in virtue of his ordination, which enables him to lawfully celebrate the sacraments that require the presence of a priest. Not every sacrament requires the presence of a priest, but for those for which priesthood is essential, he's there in that role.
Did that answer your question, Leo?
So the priest is actually the representative of Christ.
Oh, yeah.
He's not Christ, but he's a representative of Christ.
That's right. He's not Christ.
Okay, Leo? Appreciate
it. Absolve you, you know?
Say again, please.
So, like in confession, he says, I absolve you, and I know only God can forgive sin.
But Christ has delegated that power to the priest. So it's a delegated authority. I mean, he's able to forgive sins because Christ has authorized him to do so. In the same way, like the president of the country might authorize a diplomat to conclude a treaty on his behalf.
Okay.
And, you know, the diplomat's authority to do that stops the second the executive removes it. But as long as the executives have empowered him, yeah, you can speak for me in this conference. And if you're able to conclude the treaty and sign it, it'll be signed as if it were signed by me, even though you're the one that's concluding the negotiations.
Leo, thanks so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Call to Communion live on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Let's go to Sam now. Sam's in Kansas City on the Missouri side, first-time caller listening on the EWTN app. Hello, Sam. What's on your mind today?
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I'm working through, and I understand this is a very far different view from the church. I was raised oneness Pentecostal, and so that's enough of a work through as it is. But I've been just secretly attending Mass the last few months, and I'm just wondering if there's what the social culture is like in the Catholic Church, if it varies from parish to parish, or if it's specifically like a North American thing, like I said, go to a Pentecostal church. You can't make it 10 feet in the door without, without somebody recognizing you're new and coming after you. But I haven't personally had anybody greet me or, you know, reach out to me at all since I've been attending. So I'm just wondering if that's a cultural difference as far as social means go, if usually the body just attends to itself, or because I notice a lot of people, you know, as soon as the time is up too, they tend to, head for the door. So
yep.
Am I missing out on something, or is it parish to parish?
Sure. It's a great question. So I think it's worth pointing out, first of all, I understand very well what you're talking about. I know the distinction you've drawn between the culture of your Pentecostal church and the culture of the Catholic parish that you're visiting. Deliberately cultivating a culture of welcoming is not something that one finds universally across the history of the Christian tradition, whether Catholic or not. So, you know, if you were to attend, say, a Puritan church in 17th century New England, or, say, the state church in 16th century Zurich, or Calvin's church in Geneva, for that matter, or an Anglican parish during the reign of King Henry, you would find that the culture would be just as different in different ways, right? But you would feel alienated in those environments and it wouldn't be familiar to you. And so what seems sort of like the norm to you, the normal culture of parish welcoming, is in fact kind of a relic of the Free Church movement and of the culture of the Great Awakening and an emphasis on evangelism and the need to be welcoming so that newcomers will come in and they'll quote-unquote hear the gospel and be saved. And like that's all sort of packed into the theology of the culture of Pentecostalism that's grown up and been familiar to you. But it's not a constant in the history of the Christian tradition. And in particularly in the North American context, Catholics historically had a relationship to the wider culture up until, say, the mid-20th century, that I think could safely be characterized as antagonistic. I mean, Catholics were generally viewed badly by the majority culture, and there's a lot of evidence, I mean, history, in fact, of, not just discrimination, but outright persecution against Catholics. And so, I mean, to take an example from my own hometown, I was a well-known Catholic priest from Birmingham, Alabama, who 100 years ago was shot dead in broad daylight
On his front porch.
On his front porch because he performed an interracial marriage. And the murderer was actually acquitted in court, and his defense was something along the lines of the SOB had it coming to him. And the jury agreed, and they acquitted the guy for that. You know, and it used to be the case in my home state that Catholics couldn't be buried in the public cemetery. They had to be buried in their own Italian seminaries or cemeteries or Freudian slip there. And sometimes not even their children couldn't even be admitted to public schools to go to school with the Protestant kids. So in that kind of an environment where you know, they're really gunning for your life, it was natural for Catholics who tended to be restricted to certain ethnicities like Italian and Irish and Lithuanian and Polish and so forth to kind of turn inward to develop a sort of insular culture. And there wasn't a necessity to go out of their way to create a culture of welcome, first of all, because they all knew each other.
Yeah.
Second of all, they were all related. And third, visitors were not walking in the door, right? If they were walking in the door, you looked around for the exits because you got worried about it, right?
Yeah.
And so there just wasn't, there wasn't a need to develop that culture, and it didn't develop organically for the reasons that I have stated. Now, what happened after World War II is Catholics and the third generation of Catholic immigrants, they got the GI Bill, they went to college, they started becoming professionals. You know, the wide production of the automobile led to suburbanization of the American populace. So these urban Catholic parishes tended to dissolve and they were replaced by suburban churches, both Protestant and Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the social locations of Catholics changed in the culture, what didn't change was the parish culture that they had developed over generations, right? At the same time, in Protestantism, you had the fundamentalist modernist controversy, which led to the expulsion of conservative Protestants from the mainline seminaries and the deliberate attempt by Protestants to build a subcultural network of Bible colleges and Bible studies and radio stations to kind of push back against what was perceived as modernist hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
And in that context, they went out of their way to try to proselytize and recruit people to their suburban churches, chief among which were Catholics that were viewed as targets of proselytization. So they were creating social networks and bonds in exactly the locations where Catholics weren't doing that for those historic reasons. And so you're not wrong to say, hey, I see a contrast in the cultures here. Now, to the question, is that characteristic of every Catholic parish? No, it's not characteristic of every Catholic parish. I would say it's common. It's exceedingly common, but it's not universal. And in my own Catholic life, as I've traveled around the country, it really does vary from parish to parish, but I have been in Catholic communities that are smaller, particularly more rural.
Mm-hmm.
And when parishioners tend to come from the same demographic, they'll often develop more of that sort of warm and friendly culture that you're used to, but it does kind of depend on the location, the geography, and the demographics. Now, what's your takeaway from all this? Well, don't be alienated from it, right? That's the point, right? Because if you walk in, it doesn't mean there's something wrong with you, right? And it doesn't necessarily mean there's something wrong with the Catholics, right? Although, I mean, arguably, we could do a better job.
We could do a better job.
Right? We could do a better job. But the other point is that Catholics largely regard the parish as the place that they go to offer the sacrifice of the Mass and receive the sacraments. And they have social networks, but they typically develop them in other ways. And so that's a little bit of a mind shift for a convert who has thought of their local church as this is the place that I go to make relationships with like-minded people. And that's not necessarily the first thing that Catholics think, right? And so if you go in with an open mind and you say, well, I want to go to Catholic worship, but I'd also like to have Catholic friends, and you just recognize that those are two distinct goals, and you recognize you have to go about them in different ways, right? So I'm a Catholic. I'm a convert to the Catholic Church. And like you, I used to sojourn in Pentecostalism, and I have a lot of Catholic friends. I didn't make them in the parish. That's just the truth.
Yeah. Sam, thanks so much for your call. And it's kind of funny. I had to smile as Sam was laying this out and you were answering him. My wife is probably on the most hospitality end of the spectrum. If she saw Sam walking into our little parish, she would pole vault out of the choir loft and get to that person.
That's true.
Right away.
That's true. But you used a really important adjective, little.
That is true.
You said our little parish.
Sure. The smaller the parish,
the more likely
you are to have somebody.
Noticed.
Yeah,
exactly.
There you go. Sam, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Ed in Melbourne, Florida. Ed is listening to us, I believe, on Divine Mercy Radio. Nope, he's listening on the EWTN app. Ed, what's on your mind today?
Oh, good afternoon, Tom and Dr. Anders. Happy New Year.
And
I have a question. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go right ahead, Ed.
Okay. I have a question about, I happened to catch EWTN's Raymond Arroyo on his own program a couple of weeks ago, and he was interviewing a woman who I believe her name is Dr. Margaret Barker, and she was presenting her speculative theory about the identity of the three magi, the three wise men. And I don't know if you've heard of that, is question number one. And if you have heard of it, what do you think of it, and what is the Catholic Church's position on it? Is it something that the Church regards as that the lay faithful can subscribe to as an informed opinion, or is it is it contrary to Catholic teaching, or do they not have a position on it at all? And basically, her position was that she had a speculative theory that based on the idea that the Old Testament scriptures or the old tradition, Jewish Hebrew traditions, were grounded in a line of Melchizedek, of which King David, Solomon, and Josiah were all the line of Melchizedek in a priestly, kingly position that was lost after the Assyrian conquest and the Babylonian exile. And the remnants, descendants of that line, the three wise men. Well, they weren't three, actually. It was just an unknown number of wise men.
Okay, thanks. So I don't know Dr. Margaret Barker, and I haven't heard her presentation. Although, just while you're talking, I was able to find a paper that she delivered to the Society of Biblical Literature on Melchizedek.
Right? Okay.
Which I was trying to glance through while you were talking to get myself up to speed. So here's my take on this. First of all, I'm not an Old Testament, I'm not an ancient Near Eastern archaeologist or anything of the sort. That's not my area of specialty. So based on my limited lay knowledge of the material, that doesn't sound like the kind of thesis for which someone could bring forth anything like persuasive historical evidence. I think the only kind of argument that a person could make would be theological, like one starts with certain theological assumptions about kingship and prophetism in the Old Testament and reasons backwards to the preferred conclusion. I have this sneaky suspicion that the argument owes something to the Church of Latter-day Saints in their own theological doctrine concerning the Melchizedek priesthood. And so I am very skeptical about it. Very, very, very skeptical about it. It's certainly not a dogma of the Catholic faith. Whether or not it's even allowable theological opinion, I would need to know a lot more about the details of the theory, and then do some research on any kind of relevant magisterial position. But it's not the kind of thing about which the magisterium would typically utter an opinion. But it definitely doesn't strike me as in any way traditional.
Ed, thanks for checking in from Melbourne, Florida. In a moment, we'll get back to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, it'd be a great time to call while there's lines open. 833-288-3986 for the Wednesday afternoon edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Glad you're with us for a Call to Communion here on EWTN. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-298-3986. We'd love to chat with you this afternoon. Hey, congratulations to another EWTN radio partner, WMKP, FM 98.9, serving Gainesville, Georgia. They are celebrating 10 years with us this week. Congratulations to Carol Bush and Mark Peffer and their great team there at Totus Tuus Catholic Radio from your friends here at EWTN. They are wonderful, wonderful people. We're very glad to be partnering with them there in Gainesville, Georgia. All right, calls are coming in, but we're getting them screened as quickly as we can. In the meantime, we have a question for you. This is a rather long question, so bear with us here. This is from Vincent. Dr. Anders, thanks for the important work you do. I deeply value your insights and the clarity you bring to complex theological and philosophical topics. Some time ago, I was listening to a discussion on Dr. Jordan Peterson's podcast in which Carl Jung's observations about the Protestant Church were referenced. Jung noted that Protestantism's emphasis on individual interpretation and belief, while empowering in some ways, might also contribute to a fragmentation of faith and a diminished sense of communal and historical continuity. So reflecting on this, I find myself wondering whether this dynamic might inadvertently foster a kind of spiritual narcissism, where personal interpretation becomes the sole authority, leading some to view the church as, well, whatever they believe it to be. In extreme cases, this could even result in a subtle self-deification, which stands in stark contrast to the humility and submission to divine truth that Christ himself taught. I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on Jung's critique and whether you believe this tendency has impacted the modern Protestant experience. Thanks so much, Vincent.
Okay, thanks, Vincent. I really appreciate the question. Now, Vincent, I really do appreciate it, but you've put me in a little bit of a deuce of a position.
Uh-oh.
And here's why. Because the way you framed the question is, Anders, do you think that Protestantism leads to a form of theological narcissism? Now, whatever I think about the answer to that question, right? If I, there are a lot of Protestants that listen to the show,
yes,
right? And I have to be respectful and sensitive to them. And
of
so
course.
I don't want to get on the air and be construed as saying Anders thinks that all Protestants are narcissists, right? I don't want to do that. Okay,
we know better,
right? And so I want to start by like doing a little mea culpa and point the finger at my own house, okay? Which I think is the way Jesus told us to operate. Take the log out of your own eye before you take the splinter out of your neighbor's. And it is a commonplace of Catholic polemics to characterize the Catholics. The Catholic position is kind of collectivist and social, and the Protestant position is radically individualist. That's a common trope in Catholic polemical language. However, historically, regardless of the ecclesiology, it often is the case that Catholics are just really friggin' individualistic, right? And however high-minded their ecclesiology of corporate identity might be, the fact of the matter is for many Catholics, the temptation is to devolve to a kind of all I need are my sacraments, get out of my way, you're blocking my communion line, right? You know, and we just had a call a few minutes ago from a fellow who said he had wandered into a Catholic parish and felt it to be singularly unfriendly and that nobody noticed him, right? So my point is, Catholics are just as prone psychologically and spiritually to say the sin of egotism or narcissism as the next guy, right?
Yes.
Regardless of how elevated our theology may be, right? We don't live consistent with the ideals that we preach, right? So I want to get that out of the way. I don't want to be construed as saying like Protestants have got some sort of uniquely bad thing going on here, right? I'm a convert to the Catholic tradition. One of the major reasons I'm a convert to the Catholic tradition is that the way that I was brought up in the Protestant tradition, and that's just me, and I'm not speaking for everyone, definitely inculcated in me a kind of theological hubris and narcissism, right? In that, as a Calvinist, I was taught that it was important to know for sure that I was going to go to heaven when I died, which meant that I knew that I was one of the elect, and that that I knew that most people weren't, and I pretty much had the key to tell the difference. You know, I knew who was saved and who wasn't saved, and that my responsibility vis-a-vis the unsaved was to get them saved, right? Well, that makes for a very unpleasant dinner guest, right? Because it means that your disposition towards the world is, I'm right, you're wrong, and I'm going to tell you how, right?
Right.
And that was not good for me spiritually, right? Because it didn't put me in a position of humility with respect to somebody else who might have actually something to say that I needed to hear, right? And they might have more wisdom and grace and virtue than I did. Now, again, I was in a theological system that told me that virtue and kindness and charity at the end of the day aren't what justify. And so that further inoculated me against hearing good sense from other people. Because even if they were wiser or more charitable than me, hey, they didn't know Jesus the way I did, so they were going to go to hell when they died, and what do I need to hear from some reprobate, right? So it wasn't good for me. It wasn't good for me. And the dynamic that you're talking about with the, you know, the individual interpretation of Scripture, well, it had, for me at any rate, it had another pernicious effect, and that was that, you know, while I would like to think that I brought my own lights to the question of biblical interpretation, the Bible is obscure. It's a difficult book. It's not self-interpreting, regardless of what the ideologues say. And so what I ended up finding myself doing was believing the last most persuasive interpreter that I heard. And so I would get into a kind of passion of seeking out compelling interpreters of the Bible and became a kind of connoisseur of expertise. You know, not an expert myself, but a consumer of content from people who would put themselves forth as experts, and they would sell that, you know, with certain kind of rhetorical flourish and the ethos that they bring to their presentation.
Yeah.
And so while I had the illusion of sort of being in control of my thinking, what I really was the slave of propaganda, right? And so that can have the perverse and unintended consequence that you didn't anticipate of inculcating a kind of group think. And I have the scene from Monty Python's Life of Brian in mind. Yes, we are all individuals. We are all individuals, you know. And so it can actually lead to a kind of mob sentiment under the guise of a kind of individualism that is actually not achieved, right? So I do think it's a pernicious position, and I personally prefer the Catholic point of view, which does allow for individual interpretation. The Catholic Church doesn't mandate this Bible verse must be interpreted in this way. What it does instead is it puts up rail signposts. You know, they're fence posts along the way, and it says, you know, these are the boundaries that define acceptable Catholic thought. Stay within those boundaries and play all you like. And then there's a principled way of saying, you know, if I disagree with you, we don't have to come to blows because we're both, like, on the Catholic path.
Yeah. Vincent, thanks so much for your very thoughtful email. We do appreciate hearing from you. Back to the phones now at 833-288-EWTN. George is a first-time caller from Oklahoma, listening on the Great Oklahoma Catholic Broadcasting. Hey there, George. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yes. Thank you so much for taking my call. This is a very sensitive question, and I run into this in my own evangelization efforts to people who've drifted away from the church or ones who possibly are considering the Catholic faith. And it's the question that comes up of why would I want to be part of a church with scandals that the priests have been involved in and the cover-ups? And why would I want to entrust my children around priests when there's that risk of that happening?
Okay, great question. So let me answer personally, right? Because I'm a convert to the Catholic Church, and so I had to make the decision of affiliating with a church that had corrupt leadership and whether I thought that was warranted or not. And in my own case, my decision to identify with the Catholic Church had absolutely nothing to do with wanting to identify with cardinal law or with some pedophile priest or some bishop who covered up for him. That was a zero motivator for me to become Catholic. It was, in fact, motivated by my desire to be in communion with St. Augustine of Hippo and St. Francis of Assisi and St. Therese of Lisieux and St. Dominic and St. Thomas Aquinas and St. John Henry Newman and
Mother Angelica.
And Mother Angelica. And the list goes on and on and on and on and on, right? That the sanctified, virtuous, saintly Catholics who came to holiness through the resources of the deposit of faith and the sacraments stand before me as a living memorial to the grace of Christ and the Catholic Church, and I wanted to get me a piece of that, right? And I understand that membership in the Catholic Church, belonging to the Catholic Church, means that I'm a desperately wicked person who is capable of doing really bad things and have done really bad things in my life. And the church says, yeah, that's true, but redemption is possible, and here are the means, but it's up to you to use them. That guarantees that there will be people in the Catholic Church who don't use them. Don't use them enough. I'm one of them, by the way, right? I'm one of them. I haven't yet come to holiness. But I'm, again, right, my membership in the church isn't some sort of vote of confidence that I think it's administratively competent. I don't think it's administratively competent. I think the Catholic Church is administratively incompetent, very incompetent at times, right? I'm not a member of the Catholic Church because I think it's administratively competent. I think I'm a member of the Catholic Church because I think it's supernaturally capable of maintaining the deposit of faith and administering the sacraments that have the capacity to bring me to holiness, right? I mean, poor analogy. You know, why don't I renounce my American citizenship because we have corrupt politicians? Well, I mean, I think America has a lot to offer, and I'm proud of my American citizenship. I'm not proud of its leadership. You know, that's the analogy, right? In terms of entrusting my children, well, I don't entrust my children to some priest, ever. You know, I don't entrust them blindly to anybody, right? I do have my children in Catholic institutions, but they're Catholic institutions that I have vetted with leadership that I know. And I'll tell you something interesting about my own life as a Catholic. I've been a Catholic for over 20 years now. And by and large, American Catholic clergy have not come to my home, by and large. But foreign-born Catholic clergy have come all the time. They've been in my house all the time, right? And the Catholic priests that I have known of that have been involved in scandal, they're exceptions to these rules, of course, but like they're in it for themselves. They're not in it because they have a pastoral heart, right? And the ones that have ministered to my family are men that have had a pastoral heart, who are not about ladder climbing. They're willing to take the lowest place in the worst parish and you know, receive the least remuneration and have the fewest thanks. And it's because, I have one priest in particular I'm very fond of. He's a good friend of my family. He's Indian by ethnicity. He grew up in India, although he's incarnated here now. And we jokingly around the house call him the priest that says yes. Because you ask him to do anything, he says, yes. You want to come save my, yes. You want to come hear my, yes. You want to do, yes. And I said to him, I said, Father, you always say yes. It's almost funny. And he said, yeah, because that's my vocation.
Yeah,
I don't want to lose my vocation. I'm not afraid for my children to be around a guy like that, you know? But also, you know, he's not taking them on ski trips either, you know? And just because I'm prudent, right? With anybody, I'm prudent. Now, by contrast, when I was in high school, I didn't go to a Catholic high school. I went to a secular high school. I don't know what I was thinking. I was an idiot. I was 16 years old, right? I had a math teacher that came to me and about three or four of my friends and said, you guys want to go snow skiing? And we said, sure. So we all piled in the car. We drove and went snow skiing, spent the weekend with this guy. And he didn't do anything untoward except buy a lot of alcohol for people who are under the age of 21. He's dead now. And you know, 30, 40 years later, that school did a kind of internal investigation of people that were up to hinky stuff, and guess what? He was on the list. You know, and he posthumously got the sack along with a lot of other people. I learned from that experience, and that is, I don't let my kids go on ski trips with strange men or even men that I know, right? Because you never know. You never know, right?
Never know.
That's just prudence. But that's how I do it.
George, is that helpful for you?
Yes, I appreciate that, and I've always tried to communicate to these people that, you know, I'm there for the faith and what the church teaches, and none of that is invalidated by anything that a priest would do, because the sacraments are still valid, even if we have a priest that may be participating in something like that, that's not known, but still, it does not invalidate the sacraments that he performs in the church.
That's true.
Absolutely.
Yep. But, you know, one caution is just because an immoral priest can validly perform the sacraments is not an argument in favor of immoral priests, right?
No. You know,
I mean,
no.
We want virtuous, holy, sanctified moral priests. We do. Because when they don't do, they do a great amount of harm in the church. But the church will continue. That's the point.
George, thanks so much for your call. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN on our wonderful weekend program, Catholics Coast to Coast. This week, host Ace McKay checks in with the Two Becomes Family podcast. Find out ways to draw families together through reading biblical stories. And then after that, the guys on the Poco a Poco podcast will break down what real peace can be in 2026. Do check it out, Catholics Coast to Coast. Ace McKay puts it together Saturday afternoons, 2 p.m. Eastern, Sunday evening, 6 p.m. Eastern, only on EWTN Radio. I want to get to a question real quick that popped up on our screen, and then we lost the call. And you may have seen it, David. I couldn't wait to get to this call, and I'm sorry that we lost the call, but someone called in and wanted to know, is it a sin to short stocks?
Oh, I love that question. Personal opinion? No, it's not a sin to short stocks. It might be imprudent to short stocks because, you know, there's an asymmetrical relationship between shorting stocks and buying stocks with respect to the potential profit and loss ratio.
Yeah.
In buying stocks, you have a finite, you have a defined maximum risk and a theoretically infinite potential gain. When you short stocks, you have a potentially infinite loss for a finite gain, right?
Yeah,
you,
yeah.
You know, by definition, you can't quite double your money shorting stocks because you can only go to zero, right? You know, from
sure.
And then you incur margin costs as well. So there's an asymmetrical relationship of profit to loss, and your overall odds of winning are lower because historically the stock market goes up rather than down, right? So it's a dicey and risky enterprise to bet against the market and all those kinds of things. Now, there is actually an economic purpose to be served by having a short market in equities. And it's the need for liquidity, right, in a market-making system, because a lot of times when stocks or markets get particularly beat down and pessimism is high, short covering provides the buying that will stop the shortfall and start stocks in the other direction. You need to have liquidity, you know, at these inflection points in the market. And sometimes you want to have short covers in the game that can go in there and start buying up shares to cover their positions and start moving things in the other direction. So, I don't think it's intrinsically immoral to short stocks. And in fact, you know, short interest on a stock, when you track short interest, is actually a bullish signal, right?
Really?
So like a stock that's heavily shorted, mm-hmm. Is one you don't want to short. Right, because the reason why being is that when it starts going against the short sellers, then they have to scramble to cover their position, and then you get these parabolic moves up, right? So the reason somebody might be against it is they're saying, oh, well, you're trying to destroy the company, and that's typically not going to happen through short selling. I mean, companies fundamentally over the long term, their stock values are going to follow the earnings curve. And if companies are earning money, then they're going to go up and short sellers are going to get squeezed.
Call to Communion here on EWTN. Thank you for that answer. Here is Samuel now, a first-time caller in San Antonio, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio. Samuel, what's on your mind today, sir? Hey, Samuel in San Antonio, are you there? Why don't we put him back on hold, if you would, there, Pedro? We'll get to him in just a second. We got a call from Carl, who couldn't hold, but he says, I have a friend who had been Catholic. I left it, but then realized Christ founded Catholicism. However, my friend is too active at his own church to come back. Does the Catholic Church teach that he is doomed?
Yeah, so the Catholic Church says that if you understand that Christ founded the Catholic Church and you understand that you have a moral obligation to belong to it, and yet you don't belong to it, well, what position does that put you in? It puts you in the position of living at odds with your conscience,
Yeah.
Right. And to Martin Luther, who said a lot of things I radically disagree with, said one thing that I agree with. And he said, to disobey conscience is neither right nor safe. Well, to disobey conscience is neither right nor safe. Okay. But to judge a soul is God's prerogative alone. So if you ask me, do I think a person could remain habitually in disobedience to their own conscience regarding their obligation to become Catholic, and whether that would be a safe spiritual position to be in, I would say, no, that's not a safe position to be in. If you say, will that person land ultimately in heaven or hell? Well, I would say that's God's prerogative to decide, not mine.
Okay. Very good. Thanks so much for your question there, Carl. Sorry that you couldn't hang on. We're now going to go to Samuel, a first-time caller in San Antonio, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Samuel, are you there now?
Yes. Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, Samuel. Yeah, go right ahead.
Oh, yes. I just want to thank you for taking the call, but I just want to thank you for the incredible knowledge that you display about an incredible church called the Roman Catholic Church. I went to Greece and stayed 17 years in Greece studying church history, and it wasn't until I started studying the dates and everything that happened all the way up to the day that this institution is an incredible institution. It has stability, and it meets the world where it is, and it never pushes itself. It never jumps out there. And the last caller you had, not the one you just had, but the one before then, they may have forgotten that the Jesus at the church would be a corpus mixtum, so does St. Augustine. So no matter what congregation you belong to, it's a corpus mixtum. The church is mixed with weeds and wheat. But the Catholic Church has been under attack from the very beginning. And the devil doesn't usually attack anything that doesn't cause him discomfort. And it's being attacked all the way up to today, as I speak, it's being attacked. This church is an incredible church. We have stability in the magisterium. We have a history that is incredible. And you should, more Catholics should take church history in detail. And I just want to make that statement to you. It's a wonderful, incredible church.
Well, I really appreciate that, Samuel. We tend to agree with you around here. We're big fans of the Catholic Church, and I do believe that it is literally incredible. And, as a convert to the church, when I discovered Catholicism, and began to grasp something of its richness and depth and insight, I was blown away. I thought this is better than sliced bread. I mean, this is amazing stuff here, And it's not uncommon for guys like me, who may be Protestant seminarians, who've been brought up to hate Catholicism, and then they suddenly begin to discover it themselves, to literally fall into a kind of intellectual intoxication, where we are just so enamored of what we find that you just eat it up with spoons and you can't get enough of it,
And then
you become Catholic, and about 10 years later reality sets in and you realize that Catholics are human beings and people make mistakes, and parishes can be dysfunctional organizations and people can get their feelings hurt. And I told a guy one time who was interested in becoming Catholic, he was leaving the Presbyterian tradition, and I said to him, well, if you become Catholic, you're not going to get rid of your problems. You're going to get rid of the kind of problems that Presbyterians have, and you're going to assume the kind of problems that Catholics have.
Yeah. Right?
But you won't ever have a life without problems. But you want to become Catholic at the end of the day because you've made the decision that you want to live a Catholic form of life. Right? That's ultimately what it boils down to. I want my life structured in the way that the Catholic Church purports to structure my life, because I think that is the best shot I have at becoming the person that God wants me to be.
I would propose it's a better life.
Well, bingo.
Yeah. And at least it is to me. Samuel, thank you so much for your kind words. And it is absolutely true. I was thinking back as Samuel is laying all this out, and what you said is right on the money. There was a fellow that we knew socially, and he wound up working for a Catholic apostolate, and he was only there for maybe 2 months, and then he realized that we don't all bilocate, we don't all levitate, that we're human, that we have problems, but by the grace of God, we're trying to get through those problems and work them all out.
That's right.
That's all we can do. Samuel, thanks again for your phone call. We have run out of time. A very fast-moving program today. Dr. David Anders, my thanks to you,
my friend.
Thanks, Tom. And I'm also very glad that you're not hobbling quite as badly as you were yesterday.
Yeah, well, every day a little bit better.
hope for us all. Don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday here on EWTN at 2 p.m. Eastern. Do check out the podcast whenever you wish. It is available for you 24/7 at EWTN.com/podcasts. EWTN.com/podcasts. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Hey, thanks for joining us. Looking forward to our next visit tomorrow on the Thursday edition of Call to Communion. Until then, God bless.